John Hall joins me this week to discuss his new book, Drink Beer, Think Beer. This is Beersmith Podcast number 181.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 181, and it's early November 2018. This week, John Hall joins me to discuss his new book, Drink Beer, Think Beer. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They have a new Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine podcast, which I encourage you to check out. It features some of the top craft brewery owners and brewmasters discussing brewing techniques and flavors in beer. It's the podcast for those who make and drink great beer. You can find it on iTunes or at beerandbrewing.com/podcasts. And also the Riptide Pump from Blickman Engineering. Designed for homebrewers, this pump features a whisper quiet sealed housing, a removable tri-clamp stainless steel head and that is easy to clean, and a built-in relief valve for easy priming. It also has an integral Blickman linear valve for precise flow control. Get the Riptide Pump today, another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, Beersmith 3 is available now for download, and also the mobile version is out. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider recipe support to the Beersmith platform, along with integrated water tools, profiles, and mash pH tools. Dozens of new features, including cloud folders, updated databases, support for fruit juice, honey, as well as new Whirlpool hop options. Download your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome John Hall. He is senior editor at Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine, and he's a former award-winning editor at All About Beer Magazine. He's also the author of the American Craft Beer Cookbook and a beer judge. And today, we're going to talk about John's book, Drink Beer, Think Beer. John, it's great to have you back on the show. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing really well. Thanks for having me on, and welcome to my living room, where in our one bedroom apartment here in Jersey City, where the dog is excited to also be joining you today.
Nice. We're happy to have the dog and you on the show. It's actually your first time guest. I misspoke earlier, but you're working at Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine, which really just started a couple years ago, but has exploded to become one of the top publications. How are things going there?
I think things are going really well. You know, we're excited to be talking to the brewers that are making an impact in the beer world today. We're excited to be diving into processes and ingredients and talking to the brewers about what makes their beers so interesting and what makes their beers stand out and what they've learned along the way, and then communicate that on to the readers. So, you know, things are great. Things are busy. Every 2 months, the new magazine comes out, and every day we have something online for our readers at beerandbrewing.com, and video courses and everything else in between. So it's nonstop busy.
Yeah. And you were mentioning that you do a number of other products that I wasn't even aware of in addition to the magazine.
Yeah. So for the brewing professionals, there's the Brewing Industry Guide, which is quarterly. And that really sort of gets into what's happening in tap rooms and what's happening on the non-public side of beer. So, you know, in the back rooms of the breweries and the cellars, and then in the marketplace itself. And so every quarter, the Brewing Industry Guide comes out, and we again talk to industry experts from insurance and legal and beyond, and get perspectives from brewers as to what they've learned that other fellow brewers can hopefully apply to their business and make it run better, make it run smoother.
Nice. Well, you have a new book out we're going to talk about today called Drink Beer, Think Beer, and the subtitle is Getting to the Bottom of Every Pint. What makes your book a little bit different than some of the ones that are already out there?
Well, you know, what I realized when I took on this project is that there are a lot of books that get into process and ingredients and how to drink beer and individual ingredients and all manners of things that happen inside of the glass of beer itself. But in the 15 years that I've been covering beer and writing about beer, I've realized that there's so much more happening outside of the glass. And that, to me, is really sort of interesting. And so what I mean by that is, you know, talking about ingredients, but not necessarily how they're used in beer, or the way that beer is marketed to us, or the way that beer is served to us, or the way, you know, that tap rooms are perceived in today's life. There's so many things that I think discerning beer drinkers and people who haven't necessarily discovered craft beer or independent beer or small batch beer or whatever we're going to call it these days, that there's still a lot of things that people are intimidated by, especially if they're new to beer. And I wanted to remove some of the mysticism of that for them. And then I also wanted to challenge some of the more serious beer drinkers, the people who have been doing this for a while, to sometimes just pick your nose out of the glass for a minute and put your head on a swivel and look around and see what's happening around you and realize that beer is just kind of an addendum to life. It doesn't have to be the be-all, end-all to life.
And I think our relationship with beer has changed quite a bit the last 20 years or so, hasn't it?
I really think it has. It's, you know, craft beer 20 years ago was still kind of on the fringes, and the beers that were being produced were, I think, innovative in a lot of ways. They were also sort of a throwback in a lot of ways, you know, where we'd see brewers putting their own twist on Vienna lagers or British pale ales, but then giving them an American twist with a healthy dose of hops. And, you know, that was innovative and very exciting. And you know, but it's still sort of hard to come by. And these days, I mean, you can walk into your local grocery store and they'll have an entire aisle dedicated to just local, which we couldn't have 20 years ago. And the styles that are in that aisle are, boy, everything from Mexican chocolate cake flavored to, you know, double stuffed Oreo pumpkin flavored to you name it. You know, beer is sort of off the leash, as it were, and running with wild abandon right now. And that's, I think that's fun for a lot of drinkers right now, but it's certainly different than it has been in the last 20 years.
Yeah, it's certainly great that, like you said, you can walk in and get anything you want, pretty much. You start with a discussion of the modern beer renaissance, which sort of walks through how we got into this craft beer revolution. And also you highlight the important role that homebrewing played.
Absolutely. I mean, that can't be understated. And what's interesting is that you talk to, you know, folks who are turning 21 right now, or who are 23 or 25 or 27, and they've grown up knowing about craft beer. They've grown up where their parents might have consumed Sierra Nevada regularly, that it wasn't something foreign that was on the shelves like it might have been for the generation beforehand. And the further we kind of get away where different beer becomes commonplace, I think we can start to forget our history a little bit. And the way that homebrewers really played a role and a key role in reviving the beer renaissance in America is so important. And, you know, I if I had a crystal ball, I'd love to, you know, I'd probably put it to good use. But you know, if I could look back in time, but I don't imagine if homebrewers didn't play the role that they did back then, that we would have what we have in beer today. If that makes sense. That was a word jumble right there, but
no, that's okay. Okay. does that, can you walk us through the craft beer industry itself and how it evolved, over the last 25, 30 years?
Yeah. Well, I think it went from, you know, the early pioneer of Jack McAuliffe, who my dog is apparently a very big fan of.
Yep.
And, the early days of Jack McAuliffe in Sonoma County, California, who literally fashioned his own equipment together, and this is 40 years ago, but fashioned his own equipment together and created the first microbrewery from scratch. Compared to these days, where you can go to the Craft Brewers Conference, which is held in a different city each year, and you can buy a custom-made 4-barrel, 7-barrel, 15-barrel brew house right out of the box. You know, that's something that wasn't always available. You know, and in the beginning as well, we had the traditional styles, like I mentioned before, of just British pale ales. And now we have a whole host of hazy pale and hazy IPA that exists, and brute IPA. And, I think just on every level, where even some of those breweries in the beginning really had to rely on distribution and the three-tiered system and making sure that they could get access to market, be it, you know, a store or a bar or whatnot. But now the entire taproom industry for breweries is thriving, you know, and you have breweries that are making 1,500 barrels, 2,000 barrels a year, and they're selling it all directly from their own tanks, which is incredible. I mean, that's something that we certainly wouldn't have had 20 years ago or 40 years ago. So, I mean, there's so many things that have changed that I think it's a really fun time to be a beer drinker, especially if you love diversity, if you love innovation, if you love just the cool industry that that's popped up.
And you talk in your book about how there's this tension between obviously the big breweries that have been displaced, at least in part of the marketplace, and the small craft breweries. Can you walk us through a little bit of that?
Sure. Well, I mean, when Jack McAuliffe started, you had the big three. It was Bud Miller and Coors, and they ruled the land. And maybe if you were in our part of the country, you could get Yingling, you could get Shells if you were out in the Midwest, or Anchor if you were out in San Francisco. But for the most part, it was sort of Bud Miller and Coors. And when the small guys popped up, I mean, they were imperceivable gnats to these brewers, but to these large brewers. But then as they really started to grow, you would see it started to eat in on them a little bit, and they started to take on a little bit more market share, and they started to take on they were getting big enough to notice, I guess it's good to say. So of course then we saw those larger brewers flip the book and start buying small brewers, and it started with AB. Some people will say Goose Island. I think Rolling Rock kind of played a role in that pretty early on, but certainly when they bought Goose Island, that was a huge seismic shift. And then they went on to buy a dozen more, and then you see Heineken buying Lagunitas and a part of Shorts and a few other places, and you see Coors buying a bunch of breweries and Miller buying a bunch of breweries, and Mal, the Spanish brewer, getting involved with Founders, and Japanese brewers getting involved with Brooklyn. So the large brewing conglomerates are definitely seeing the value in craft and seeing the value in small, and they're doing whatever they can to add that into the fold to keep the sales of some of their flagships, which are lagging, from having too much of a negative impact on their bottom line.
And even the meaning of the word craft beer is hotly contested these days, right?
I think it is. The thing is, we always used to know what craft meant, and even if it didn't mean quality, because craft has never actually equaled quality, it more meant small, and it meant family owned. It had that certain that ring to it where if you heard it would sort of make you feel good. And then the larger players who bought Goose Island or bought Revolver or bought any of these other brands that are out there, they kept using that word, and they kept saying, well, we're still craft, we're still small, we might be part of a big company, but we're still small. And the word became much more of a marketing term and less about what the customer was getting. Dunkin' Donuts sells craft lattes now, and the Chapstick brand of lip balm has their own craft collection, and you go into Quick Check and they have artisanal sandwiches, handcrafted artisanal sandwiches. So the whole word has sort of become a little silly, a little meaningless. I think it served a good purpose when it did, but these days I don't think that it is quite as impactful as it once was, even 5 years ago.
And the ownership obviously plays a big role here.
I think the ownership plays a very big role here. I think when people vote with their dollars, we don't always have a chance to buy artisanal cell phones, and we can't necessarily get You know, we have three major makers of mobile phones, and you know, we don't get our internet from, you know, mom and pop providers. But there are certain products where, and beer is one of them, where we can meet the owners, where we can walk into a brewery and see the equipment where our beer is made. We can see when our dollars pass over the bar for a 4-pack or a 6-pack or just a pint. We can see the people who that sale will benefit directly, you know, in the bartenders, in the cellar workers, in the delivery drivers, and more. And so I think ownership is important in that way, because if you are small and you do have that mom and pop and that entrepreneurial spirit, because it can help you forge a deeper relationship with the beer that you're drinking and the breweries that make it. And, you know, the word that's out there right now is independent. So not owned by a big, large brewing conglomerate. I struggle with that word as well, because again, it goes back to independent doesn't always equal quality. And to me, at the end of the day, I would drink 1,000 Budweisers before you know, I'd force myself to finish a pint of stout that was teeming with diacetyl that was made by a smaller brewery, regardless if they're independent or not. So you know, some of these words that we put in front of beer and some of these words that we use to describe breweries are important for some, but they don't always address the elephant in the room, or don't always address the experience that I think we all deserve to have when it comes to drinking beer.
Do you think the loss or the separation of the direct relationship, you were talking about the owner being close to his customers, which certainly has some benefits. Do you think as that relationship starts to break down, as more and more of these regional breweries are sold to larger companies, is that going to place some of the craft beer at risk, perhaps? The industry at risk?
Sure. Boy, again, if I had that crystal ball, I don't know. I think that in some ways, yes, the brewers will feel, smaller brewers will feel the squeeze, you know, but beer in general is struggling because people aren't category loyal anymore. It used to be, oh, I'm a beer drinker, or oh, I'm a wine drinker, or I only drink, you know, scotch or bourbon or vodka or whatever. But these days, with the younger generation of drinkers who are coming up, you know, it seems one like they're drinking less overall. But more than that, it when they go out, they might start their night with a pint of beer, and then they might switch to a glass of wine with dinner, and then they might have a cocktail to finish up at the end of the night. And so that's three major categories. And that is, I think, hurting everybody overall. So the competition that the smaller players are facing doesn't necessarily come from big beer, but it's coming from multiple angles. It's coming from other segments. It could potentially, depending on where you are in the country, it could be coming from cannabis as well. And so I think it's going to be hard to be a beverage producer going forward. But the nimble ones, the ones who listen to the marketplace, the ones who maybe don't overextend themselves too much with debt or too much, you know, growth for the sake of growth, I think might be able to get through the next couple of years as everything sort of shakes out and figures itself out. But again, that's my best guess. If I was on the money with any of these things, you know, I'd be on Wall Street right now, trading big deals.
Yeah.
But instead, I'm, you know, here in my my dining room with you guys.
Okay. Going through some more of the book, you do have a chapter on the four basic ingredients, where you kind of get inside the glass, if you will. But I think most of our listeners are pretty familiar with those.
I hope so.
But you next go into flavors, which I think is an important topic. So I was wondering if you want to talk for a minute about flavor.
Yeah, you know, it's such an interesting thing, because I mentioned before that I wouldn't drink a stout teeming with diacetyl. And when it is an actual flaw in the beer, where the brewer hasn't done a proper diacetyl rest, where the brewer hasn't isn't picking up on it, where it's certainly something that shouldn't be in there, I don't want to drink it. But what's interesting is there are beers that have been made, like lobster stouts, where a little diacetyl, where you get the perceived butter to go along with this shellfish stout, as it were, can add a twinge of complexity and a twinge of sort of something interesting to it. At the,
I like butter with my lobster, so that makes sense.
Sure, but we've also been taught to learn that it's a flaw, and so it certainly is, but except when it's deliberate. So I was at the Great American Beer Festival this year, and Randy Mosher, the great and wise Randy Mosher, was pouring for Forbidden Root at his brewery in Chicago, and he had this cherry ale. I forget the base style, but it had this twinge of diacetyl in it, this sort of tart butteriness to it that had a little bit of tang. And as I was drinking it, Randy said to me, "Think of a cheese Danish with cherry." And in my brain, it crystallized, and that's exactly what it tasted like. And he was quick to admit that in the experimental category, the fruit category, whatever he entered it in, that the brewers would probably throw it out because of diacetyl, because they saw it as a flaw. But when he was talking to each customer, especially knowledgeable drinkers, and fully admitting the diacetyl and having us think about it in a different way, man, I ran into four or five people during the course of that festival who said, "Have you had Randy's cherry beer with the diacetyl, but it's really good?" And I said, "Yeah, I did." And so when we think about flavor, that's sort of the other cool thing about beer these days is, yes, sometimes things are off flavors, and then in very rare and other cases, it's not. And mm-hmm. So it's, I think I say somewhere in the beginning of the book that beer is a series of contradictions. And that to me is certainly one that stands out in my mind.
And how have the flavors evolved, even over the short period of time we've had with the craft beer brewing exploding, I guess? We have seen quite a bit of change over that period of time, right?
100%. When you think about Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, when that was introduced in the very early 1980s, 1980, 1981, it has 32 IBUs, something like that. If I'm wrong, I'm sure your listeners will come and correct me. But it's something like ridiculously small by today's standards. But back then, it was revelatory. And I remember the first time that I had one, and it was like, wow, this is like a huge hop punch. These days, it's the IBU's arms race, and that's still happening. And by comparative sake, like, Sierra Pale seems kind of quaint. You know, it seems like, oh, it's the, you know, little old lady who drives, her Buick to church on Sundays. It's kind of sweet and innocent in today's crazy world. And what's interesting is, you know, that's an award-winning beer. That is a beer that when you still talk to brewers and you still talk to beer drinkers of a certain age, it is the benchmark of the style. It is what people should strive for. It is a beer that has inspired so many people and is just a delight to drink time and time again. The brewery itself doesn't enter it into the pale ale category at the Great American Beer Festival anymore because they won't win. The flavors have moved so far beyond that now that the style or the beer that helped define a style or arguably defined a style of the American pale ale no longer can compete against what's being made today because we have just swam so far into the ocean of hops that we can't even see the shore anymore.
And is that you think that trend
metaphor before? I hope that works.
What was that?
I hadn't used that metaphor before, so I hope that works.
Well, I mean, is this trend going to continue? The IPAs have kind of taken over the U.S. beer market. I think almost many craft beer.
Look into the future, you know. It's like if I could look into the future, I don't know how many times I can say.
Better at predicting the past myself, but I'm more successful, anyways.
30% accurate, yeah, on the past. Yeah, I think it'll continue, but I also think that the pendulum does swing back. You know, I do think that beer is probably a pendulum and that at some point, brewers will go backwards. You know, everything old will be new again, as it were. You know, it's cool right now. We're seeing the lager renaissance. I mean, you talk about an old school style. You talk about something that the industry was built on and something that has such tremendous history. I mean, you know, Dave Carpenter's book on the subject is just fascinating. And and I love it. It's Carpenter's book, right? Yeah. Yeah,
Dave Carpenter's, I think so, yeah.
Yeah. It's just fascinating on the subject. And, you know, and then you look at places like in Massachusetts, like Notch in Salem, or Bierstadt in Denver. You know, these places that are recommitting to the art of lager, and the fact that you see large brewers like Founders, like Firestone Walker, even Sierra Nevada, you know, come out with everyday drinking lagers, I think shows that there is a market for it. You know, one, it speaks to the 87% of beer drinkers that aren't in the craft category, and it gives them new choice and new variety aside from Bud Miller and Coors. But they're also selling to the 13%. They're also selling to, you know, to beer drinkers like the two of us, and we're drinking it up with glee. I'm seeing more milds come on now, and yeah, I am seeing a return to single hop pale ales again, which is really nice. And so I do think that by its nature and what has been created in the last 40 years, brewers will continue to innovate, will continue to push the boundaries, will continue to try to find uncharted waters. But I also do think that there will be folks who are grounded in the past and have respect and reverence for the past, and they will continue to make those classic styles and bring them to us. And I hope there's an audience for it. You know, long after the two of us are gone.
Yeah, one of the frustrations for me is that the IPAs are great, but they've been forcing out so many of the other styles that indeed, when I go to the grocery store now, it's very hard to find some of the styles that I enjoy.
Yeah, no, you know, it's interesting. And I'm fortunate in this job. I get to visit a lot of breweries, and it's always kind of frustrating for me when I walk into a place and it's 10 beers on tap and 8 are variations of double dry hopped, hazy, juicy pale ale. And the other 2 are pastry stouts. You know, because it's just, there's not a lot of variety. And if I'm not in the mood to, you know, drink my beer with a knife and fork, or, you know, walk out with diabetes, it's sort of tough. And I know that I'm the minority, with some beer drinkers when it comes to that. But, I was just out in Iowa last weekend, and I stopped by a brewery called 515, which is in Des Moines. And boy, their tap list was so diverse. You know, they had a couple of wheats on, and they had a West Coast IPA. They did have a newfangled juicy IPA, I believe. And, you know, they had a barley wine on, and, you know, all sorts of things, an ESB, a mild. There was really something for everyone. And in looking around the tap room when I was there, it was a fairly diverse crowd. It wasn't all, you know, hazy drinkers, or, you know, people who identify as hazy drinkers. It was, you know, really a combination of the population. And so I think the brewers that make that kind of thing and put in the effort to having diverse tap lists, I still dig that when they do that. And I wish more places did.
Well, I'm going to move on to your next topic in your book is actually drinking beer. And you talk a little bit about sort of judging beer, tasting beer, drinking beer, how to enjoy beer more.
Yeah, you know, what's so fascinating to me is when I'm out at the bar, the folks who are seemingly excited to taste new things, to try new things, very rarely stop to savor what they're doing. And I don't mean that you have to do the, you know, the appearance and the sniffing of the aroma or feeling for mouthfeel with every sip. But it's amazing to me watching folks sometimes who just, you know, they take a quick sip, they barely consider it, and then they immediately log on to Untappd to check it in. Or, you know, they you know, take their picture for Instagram, or they, you know, any number of things to sort of share with the wider world what they're doing in that moment. And when you are tasting beer, it is such a personal experience because, you know, in the same way that we were just saying that, you know, there's some styles that we might not prefer or, you know, things that we might not seek out. You know, there might be somebody sitting next to us at the bar who really does like that. And so, you know, if I'm drinking a mild and, you know, you're drinking a triple and, you know, we should enjoy those moments because we're the only one who's having that experience in that moment. And just stopping and considering flavor and considering the combination of ingredients and, you know, just giving the brewer its proper due, if proper due is due, you know, I think that with so much choice out there, we can forget to just actually stop and taste for a moment. And I'd like to see that come back as well.
How has the beer industry sort of evolved and changed over the years? And you have a whole chapter talking about shadows in beer.
Yeah, you know, so shadows in beer is an interesting chapter to write, and it was really introspective in a lot of ways. Because I do think that if you cover the beer industry like we do, and you go to a lot of beer industry events like we do, and you know, you spend your time around. You know, whenever I tell people what I do and, you know, I'm guessing Brad, you get the same thing. People are like, wow, that's so cool. Could I have your job? You know, and it is really cool and it is a lot of fun. And, but I do think that people think what we do is a constant party. And
it is, by the way, for those of you out there, it's one big party.
Well, then I need your job apparently. Yep. 'Cause you know,
absolutely.
I like to joke that the mornings are difficult in this job. But right there, you know, a hangover joke, you know, it's true. You know, sometimes we over imbibe. Sometimes we have one too many or two too many. And then there's some folks who need to have multiple beers a day to function and to keep on. And it's something that we don't talk about all that often. But it exists, you know. Alcoholism is real and a real struggle for a lot of people. You know, there are stigmas that, you know, women can get if they have a beer while pregnant, you know, which is kind of silly in a lot of ways. You know, there's health issues associated with beer. You know, it's I'm the first to admit that I need to drop a couple of pounds. You know, I go out, I drink a fair amount when I'm out, and I don't always exercise to keep that weight off when I put it on. And so, you know, for me, tackling that in the book, I wanted to sort of remind people that this is happening, and also, you know, remind people that it's okay to talk about it, because talking can lead to action, and talking can lead to meaningful consequences. And, you know, it's not always a party. You know, this is a, you know, this is a substance that can alter your state of mind in some ways. And I think we need to remember that. And I think we need to have a healthy respect for it. And for the makers as well, there needs to be a healthy respect for the customers. You know, the nonsense that exists when, you know, folks are putting misogynistic sayings on labels, or, you know, homophobic or xenophobic, or, you know, any sort of disparaging comments on their packaging or their beer names and getting it out there. You know, like they need to knock that crap off as well. You know, but that exists right now. You know, every couple of weeks we see it on Facebook or Twitter or whatnot of some, you know, bonehead brewery that didn't stop and think for a second, and they come under a well-deserved hellstorm for trying to marginalize a gender or a group or, you know, just a person. And we can't have that. You know, it that shouldn't exist in today's society, you know, for one, but, you know, beer should be fun, and it should be you know, something that is all inclusive. You know, beer doesn't know gender, beer doesn't know politics, beer doesn't know as the liquid itself. And I think that brewers should try to remind themselves of that now and again if they're potentially headed down a perilous path.
Yeah. Well, on a lighter note, let's go.
Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln,
let's go to the next section. Yeah, you do talk about the what goes on outside the glass, and you got chapters both on drinking in brew pubs and how we enjoy beer in a brew pub, which has changed dramatically since I turned 21 anyways. And also you talk about drinking at home and how they're different. Can you walk us through, sort of how those environments have evolved during the craft beer industry revolution here?
Well, sure. I mean, I think the biggest thing about drinking beer out in the larger world is the more variety of, draft beer that's out there. You know, again, you used to walk into a place and they'd have three taps and you knew exactly what was on those three taps. And now you can walk into a place and there's some places that boast 100 taps or 200 taps. But, you know, even if you walk into a place with a dozen taps, you're going to be getting different beers from different breweries. And I think that as we become more educated consumers, you know, we should be thinking about the draft lines. And we should be questioning how far the pour is from the keg to the tap. You know, a lot of the times when I see those 150 tap places, boy, their tap lines run for 150 feet, if not more. And there's a lot of beer sitting in that line in the meantime. And boy, help you if you get that pint that's poured where the beer's been sitting in there for 20, 30 minutes or God forbid overnight, as it were. So sort of being aware of how your draft beer is being dispensed to you, and then also what it's being dispensed into. I'm on Facebook and Instagram quite a bit, and I'm in a bunch of these Facebook groups for beer appreciation or following folks who are beer fans. And I am continuously amazed when I see people pour good beer or beer that they are genuinely excited about into a dirty glass. And by that, I mean, carbonation sticking to the inside of the glass, indicating soap scum or food residue or whatnot. And I see it at bars all the time these days. And most people, if you're not finally tuned into what's happening, they're like, oh, just look at the carbonation. That's so nice. They don't necessarily know that that's not supposed to be there in the same way that if you got a dirty fork at a restaurant, you would immediately send it back to the kitchen. So I do think that beer service, excuse me, has changed quite a bit, but that the customer needs to be a little bit more savvy when it comes to how their beer is getting to them. And the other part of that too is, the glass itself, regardless if it's clean or dirty, I'd love to see the shaker pint just go away and see some specialty glassware and some more bars put some thought into using proper glasses and thinner glass that doesn't hold heat quite as much and all manners of things that can make the beer drinking experience that much better when you're out at a bar. But to continue on your point, like those are some of the things that you can do at home. You can have specialty glassware at your house. You can make sure that your glass is finally rinsed and clean and ready. Which again surprises me when I see folks who don't do that at home. If you have a kegerator, obviously you're gonna be cleaning your draft lines, I would hope. But the thing that's really, I think, changed in a lot of ways for folks is when they're drinking at home, they don't even have to drink local anymore. We've seen beer trading take off like crazy in the last couple of years. And, so I have friends who are here in New Jersey who are drinking California brewery only releases because they've shipped beer back and forth in the mail. I've stopped by places and people have beer cellars now where that used to be that they just would have, wine cellars, two, three generations ago. People are now building beer cellars. So I think because of the growth of breweries, because of the growth of the number of beers that they're making and some of the beers that are built for longevity or built for special occasions or just built for everyday gawking, as it were, or bragging rights or whatnot, that we've seen beer at home change quite dramatically than just picking up a six of your favorite on your way home from work and downing them while watching Monday Night Football.
Yeah, and I think we drink in a much different way than we did years ago either. I mean, the brew pub as it is now didn't really even exist 20 years ago, really.
No, well, I mean, when you say brew pub, I guess you mean like tap room, right?
Yeah,
because brew pubs themselves, I mean, and that's the interesting thing. There are fewer and fewer breweries of the 6,700 that are in there right now that are brew pubs that are breweries that also serve their own food. Mm-hmm. That is increasingly rare. So it's tap rooms now that have food trucks that are separate businesses from their, like, you know, they have a symbiotic relationship, but they, but they're not necessarily connected. So that's really the big thing, because back in the day, as you know, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners do as well, it was the food that got people in the door. You needed to have a good burger in order to move your house-made beer. You know, you needed to have those banging fish and chips in order to, you know, hopefully move that that Hefeweizen. So, you know, but these days people walk in and they're like, you know, yeah, it's cool that there's a taco truck outside, but I'm here for the hazy IPA, or I'm here for the pastry stout, or I'm here for, you know, the rare bottle release, or whatever it is. So, yeah, that I think is really sort of the biggest thing that's changed, is that people come to breweries now just for the beer itself and for the experience, and to feel like they are a bigger part of something that's happening, as opposed to some of those early days where there were people who were seeking it out for those reasons. But more often than not, I would theorize that, you know, in the past, non-beer people who would go to these would do it so for novelty's sake.
Well, you have a chapter at the end called The Death of Subtlety, and you start it with a line, you open it with a line, I worry about beer. What are your concerns there?
Well, and this is the thing, that beer is a series of contradictions, but when we have beers that taste like s'mores, or beers that taste like German chocolate cake, or beers that are supposed to taste like Hawaiian punch, which is something that I had over the weekend, or that are supposed to, it wasn't bad actually, but it didn't taste like beer. And that's my worry, is that at the end of the day, if I'm drinking a beer, or something that is being marketed to me as a beer, I would love to get some of the nuance that exists in beer. You know, I'd like a little hop bite, or I'd love a little malt derived sweetness, you know, or I'd love to, you know, if local water comes into play, I'd love to have some of that, or, you know, some nice yeast driven phenolics or esters. But when it's, the beers are just mimicking a hard lemonade or a hard iced tea, and it's basically flavored alcohol, that's when I start to worry about beer in the way that that beer is headed. But again, it goes to the younger generation these days, who they won't drink Sierra Nevada because they don't like the, you know, they won't drink Torpedo because they don't like the bitterness at the end of it. And they're so used to, you know, sort of this more rounded sweetness, you know, that we're getting from the hazy, juicy IPAs, and not embracing, you know, the bitterness is, I don't know, I think you miss out on something. And so I do worry about beer in the way that if we're not tasting beer, but it's being marketed to us as beer, where is this industry headed? And again, if I had that crystal ball, I wish I knew, but, you know, I might long for the days of just being able to, you know, get an IPA where there's a little bit of a hop bite at the end of it. Cause, it does seem like it's getting rarer and rarer, especially among the newer and newer generations of brewers.
Well, along those lines, we've started to see a leveling off of the double-digit growth in craft beer now. Are we facing a little bit of an oversupply here? I think we're at, what, 5,000-6,000 breweries now, right?
7,000.
Yeah, okay, 7, well. I mean, are we getting to the point where we have too many breweries?
I don't know, is what it comes down to. I don't think so, personally. But I don't know for sure. So, for example, where I live in Jersey City, New Jersey, it's a city of 260,000 people, and we have one brewery. You know, and it's a nice brewery. It's a 7-barrel system. You know, nice guy. Maybe it's a 15. I can't remember now, but you know, nice guy. But man, I'd love to see, you know, some competition happen in the city. I'd love to have you know, 2 or 3, 4 breweries for 260,000 people, each doing something different, each standing out on their own, each trying to, you know, make a name for themselves in whatever they felt passionate about, beer wise. And so, no, I don't think that we have too many, but I do think that there are some breweries that should really think about, you know, why they're doing this. You know, if you're a brewery who is still putting out diacetyl lagers or diacetyl stouts in this day and age, there's no excuse for that. Like that, you know, especially like if you haven't figured out how to control your recipes and to control your beer and you're putting out flawed pints, it might be time to think about something else, because to do something else, because there are people who are hitting it on all cylinders, both big and small. And soon enough, the market will catch up with you if you're not making great beer commercially. And it's going to be really difficult to stay in business. You know, but I don't think we have too many. But I do think that we need to make sure that the ones that are open are doing right by the proud tradition that they come from and the shoulders of the giants that they're standing on.
I mean, is this just part of the ebb and flow of the regular business cycle, maybe?
Sure, I think so. Businesses close. I mean, anytime a brewery closes these days, I think there's people who are saying, oh my God, is this the end? Is this the bubble? Is this the beginning? And it's like, no, like restaurants close all the time. And sometimes it's just because after 10 years or so, the chef just decides that they want a new challenge or they want something else to do, or rent got too high and they couldn't afford it anymore. You know, law firms come and go, insurance agents come and go. I mean, you look at your Main Street USA these days, there's, you know, a new nail salon that comes up every time one closes, or, you know, sometimes you have vacant storefronts before, you know, a knitting store comes in because knitting is popular in the moment. And then when knitting is not anymore, then the cupcake store comes in. So I think businesses open and close all the time. But because we are so focused on beer in what we do and how we interact, that any time that we're seeing these closures right now, they feel a little more acute. But if they, I do think if they start to pick up at a pretty extreme pace, there should be a little bit cause of concern, and you know, we should really take a hard look at the ones who close and really examine why. You know, was it a brewery that just had its natural run and was ready to go, or was it one that was in a town or an area that had a bunch of breweries and they were the weakest link and people voted with their dollars? You know, so there'll be some interesting autopsies that are done, and hopefully that'll give us some better answers. But I haven't pulled out the scalpel just yet.
Yeah. Well, what are your closing thoughts, John, on the beer industry as a whole and craft beer brewing in particular?
You know, I'm privileged to do what I do. When people tell me their stories, when I can share their stories in print and on our podcast and online, I'm really grateful for that. And what I see is an industry that is really still fueled by passion, and an industry that is filled with curious people from all walks of life, of all bents, of all manners of thoughts and backgrounds and professions, all coming together because they enjoy beer and they enjoy the way that beer makes them feel, and they enjoy gathering at tap rooms. And so, I'm excited for what's happening right now. I say in the book, and you know, I say to anybody who listens, I mean, this is the coolest time in the history of mankind to be a beer drinker. There's never been as much choice. There's never been as much knowledge. There's never been as much passion. And I'd love to see that continue on a upward trajectory.
Well, John, I want to thank you again for coming on the show. Really appreciate you being here.
Thanks, pal. It was great talking with you.
My guest today was John Hall. John is the senior editor at Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. He's also an author and a beer judge. John, thank you again for coming.
Hey, it was my pleasure. Thanks for hanging out in my dining room tonight.
Well, a big thank you to John Hall for joining me this week. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They have a new Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine podcast, which I encourage you to check out. It features some of the top craft brewery owners and brewmasters discussing brewing techniques and flavors in beer. It's the podcast for those who make and drink great beer. You can find it on iTunes or at beerandbrewing.com/podcasts. And also Blickman Engineering, creators of the Riptide Pump. Designed for home brewers, this pump features a whisper quiet sealed housing, a removable tri-clamp stainless steel head, and a built-in relief valve for easy priming. Get the Riptide Pump today, another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, Beersmith 3 is available for download now for both desktop and mobile platforms. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider support, new Whirlpool hop options, support for high-altitude brewing, and a whole lot more. Check out Beersmith 3 and get your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.